Okay, now we have three things happening. We have four things happening in the last session. First, we have two presentation papers. First by Saul and Patrick. Patrick's not here, so Saul will be giving it. And then a paper done by Stuart Reeves for representing Christian Kriepenhagen and Mark Perry. Then we'll have a short break, where one of the important aspects of the day will reach fruition, namely the cake off presentation prize. So that'll be a point in which we can all huzzah the wonderful cakes that we've all been consuming. I'm trying to kind of spin this out in a way that allows people to come in, because the chair has just arrived, so it's wonderful to have you. So as the chair was saying, we have
Saul speaking on behalf of himself and Patrick Healy, our conversational assessment sequence is evaluated. Thank you, Saul.
Thank you. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is whether this routine sequence of action that we often talk about in CA as conversation assessments achieves evaluations interactionally. So assessments are commonly identified in CA as utterances that offer an evaluation of a referent with a clear valence, that's a definition I've seen used often, or utterances that are positively or negatively valenced through the use of conventional assessing terms. But the concept of positive or negative valence is a normative one, and to explore how valence is used and recognised as positive or negative, in practice we may need to look at how people work to achieve evaluations through interaction. And I think most ethno-methodologists would agree with Wittgenstein's point, where he says that conventional terms like good or beautiful or bad and ugly have no inherent valence. Instead, he suggests we look at the occasions and situations in which the aesthetic expression has a place. And so this talk focuses on one such place, or more specifically, on a sequential location and a phenomenon of retrosequential assessment. So first I'm going to start by looking at how people have approached assessments in the CA literature, and I'll explain my approach to assessments, to finding occasionally co-present assessments in several different data sources. Then I'll introduce retrosequential assessments, and I'll give you some examples of those, and show how an expanded understanding of assessment sequences, including prospective and retrosequential organisations, opens up opportunities for exploring how evaluations may be achieved. And then I'm going to show you how people produce evaluations in ways that kind of index concurrent experiences. And I hope we'll have time to then discuss whether this analysis points to some broader systematic evaluative framework in interaction. So what do we know about assessments in CA literature? This has already been reviewed a few times today, but I'll do it again. In her 1984 paper, Pomerantz identifies the preference organization of first and second assessments, where the second assessment normatively upgrades the valence of the first. And in this paper, she makes two seminal claims that have been used very often. The first is that when somebody does an assessment, if the thing that they assess is expectably accessible to the other, that provides for the relevance of the upgraded second assessment. And if you look at your handouts, you'll see in extracts 1 to 3, these are the examples of occasionally co-present assessments that Pomerantz uses in her paper. And what she says follows from this is that assessments are produced as byproducts of participation, so that by doing a second assessment, people display their experience of and participation in whatever is being assessed. And if you look at extract 4, this is a piece of evidence she offers to show through declinations to assess where they do not have access. This is how this evidence accrues. And so in CA, we've tended to follow Pomerantz by identifying assessments in data by looking for these conventionally valenced lexical assessment terms. And contemporaneously with Pomerantz, Goodwin and Goodwin take a slightly different approach. They still start with these conventional assessment segments, as they call them, the terms. And then they look at what happens before and after and during these assessments, and they look at the sequential environment of those terms. So at gaze, at bodily orientation, and at the different kinds of activities that are constitutive of more diffuse assessment activities, as they say. But even by the late 80s, Shegloff had already pointed out that perhaps we should think of assessments and evaluations as forms of description, and explore them in sequentially sensitive ways, rather perhaps than typing them as these highly routinized structures of initial and subsequent pairs. And there are many analysts who've subsequently pointed out that there are problems with treating assessments and related action types as distinct action types formed as these prospective pairs. So what some of these problems that I should mention, well, when I asked on the EMCA hashtag on Twitter for examples of particular kind of assessments from the literature, I got this rather striking assessment from Edward Reynolds. And others have pointed out in more scholarly publications that some of the problems that arise from treating assessments as canonical action types. So Stivers and Rossano famously point out in their mobilising response paper that is cited very often, that first assessments in co-present interaction don't necessarily occasion paired second assessments, and they suggest more granular features of syntax and turn design and epistemics that may be required to mobilise response to these non-canonical actions, as they call them. And Thompson, Fox and Cooper Coolin, in their recent book on responsive actions, ask whether it's even clear that assessments constitute an identifiable pattern of prospective action sequences. So I'd say that there are some other problems that we could look at that mostly arise from the way that we select data for explorations of assessments. If we use conventional terms like good or beautiful or bad or ugly to select our data, we may miss out on evaluations that don't use these terms. And by exploring the sequential environment in which those terms arise, we may focus on conventional assessment activities or situations where assessments are kind of caricaturishly expectable. So when somebody, when you taste a plate of food that somebody's just cooked for you, or at a wine tasting, or after a haircut, these are the kind of situations where we might expect to see these kind of conventional assessments. And storytellings or reports of past events and activities, these are the situations that Pomerantz and Goodwin and Goodwin and many others in these early explorations of assessments mostly focus on, reports of past events and activities. And this tendency may have influenced how we've then developed assessments and how they've been treated in the CA literature. So what can we discover about assessments that aren't premised necessarily on such conventionalized terms of situations, and where can we find those? I started by looking for a perspicuous setting where people would be ongoingly available to one another as potential speaker and recipient by virtue of their co-presence, rather than, as Shegloff says, a telephone talk, as an explicit purpose of talking to one another on the phone. And I wanted to find situations where people would be likely to do evaluations, but without necessarily using conventional terms or knowing what the relevant parameters would be. So I didn't look at wine tastings, for example, where certain terms and expert terminologies would be part of some expected activity and for the purpose of wine tasting. Rather, I looked for situations where assessments were incidentally occasioned by co-presence and didn't arise necessarily as a kind of routine activity that Wiggins and Potter call category assessments, and that Goffman terms this orientation gloss. So I collected 50 conversations between gallery visitors to the Tate Modern, overlooking a really obnoxiously obscure piece of contemporary performance art by Tino Segal called These Associations, which he made in 2012. I really like that piece, by the way. It's just rather obscure. And this involved 60 performers mingling with the crowd in the hall and then moving around in these striking flocking patterns. And people would walk in from the banks of the Thames not necessarily knowing what to expect or to expect this particular performance. And it wasn't signposted or clearly marked out in any way. And I recorded the conversations of people who congregated on the balcony here and transcribed and analysed them to see if they were doing evaluations, and if so, how the assessment sequences that they were using were organised. And the artist only allowed me to use audio recordings. And because of these incidental recordings that were just from static microphones, as you'll hear, the audio quality was rather limited, and I had serious constraints on what kinds of analysis I could do. But after identifying specific patterns in these conversations, I looked for similarly organised structures in audio recordings of talk between participants in the demographic British National Corpus. That's the part of the British National Corpus made up of recordings from balanced socioeconomic groups of people walking around in the early 90s with tape recorders all around the UK. And they were just recording their daily lives. So I developed a corpus of 4.2 million words, and you can find this corpus online. Christoph talked about it earlier in his talk. I mean, this let me perform searches for sequentially sensitive structures. So one of the recurrent structures I found at the Tate and then explored in the CABNC were retrosequential assessments. And I'll show you some examples, but first I'll just say a few things about retrosequences. Shegloff describes retrosequences as launched from second position, invoking a first as a prior tacit source. So retrosequential assessments, therefore, put on offer the optional relevance of displaying recipiency to the action by responding to it, the optional use of this assessable resource that's just been invoked for achieving some kind of joint assessment, and the optional assessment relevance of that retrosequential action. So in the following extracts, participants use this opportunity to manage the respective degrees of access to the assessables invoked and the intelligibility of these assessables in ways that I think work towards doing evaluation. So finally, we're going to start with one. This is extract one in your handouts. This is a retrosequential assessment from the CABNC in which evaluation is achieved without the use of conventional terms like good or beautiful or bad or ugly. And we have Annette and Helen. They're walking home when a motorcycle revs up next to them. And notice how Annette invokes the sound of the motorcycle as incidentally occasioned and then only formulates it as an assessable once Helen responds by saying what. Play the clip. So the sound is clearly audible to Helen, but it's not yet intelligible to her as an assessable resource until Annette gets the opportunity to reproduce it as a kind of reported sound. So the way that she does this reconstitutes it retrospectively as having been assessment relevant and as an assessable that both parties then work on reflexively, managing the relevance of their roles as speaker and recipient and the relevance of the action as having been an evaluation. In this next clip, this is one from the Tate Modern, and it's very indistinct, so listen carefully. Jim and Alison have been standing next to some French people who have been joking and laughing about the performance. And Jim assesses the French people's banter. And he seems to assume that since Alison can clearly hear it, she also shares access to it. And after Alison's response, you'll hear a silence, which I've cut out, 48 seconds, that ensues. So after eavesdropping, they sit in silence.
What are they talking about?
What are they talking about? Like, big
so a lot of headphone work went into these transcripts. So here, Alison's initial response censures Jim for eavesdropping on the conversation, so it places a kind of moral constraint on the assessment of the French people's talk, and then has to work quite hard after this long silence to recover first the laughter relevance and the assessment relevance of his initial turn, some 48 seconds previously. And so she laughs responsively in asking what they were saying, and this suggests her shared access to the sound, but her lack of access to the intelligibility of it, so that maybe she doesn't speak French, and gives Jim the opportunity to reformulate and translate the assessable. Finally, in extract 8, we're back at the Tate with Rob and his daughter Abby have just arrived on the balcony. There's some crosstalk here again. And we can see that first Rob and then Abby clearly display joint access, but each in turn withholds revealing any further explication or revealing their intelligibility of this resource.
I know what it is. What's the time, Mr. Wolf?
So Rob's initial noticing displays access to, oh, it's one of these things, but suspends any further description, which draws Abby into this game that Sachs calls withholding the what, which effectively displays private access or subjective access, but withholds any shared intelligibility. And Abby isn't so good at this game. She can't contain her solution and describes it as this English children's game of what's the time, Mr. Wolf. And then Rob picks up on her explanation and pursues this, oh, is the one in the middle the wolf? So a valence doesn't really emerge here, but it's potentially on offer, I think. So what can we say about evaluation if we add this analysis of retrosequential assessments to our existing understanding of Pomerantz's prospectively paired, normatively upgraded sequential assessments. As I mentioned in relation to Abby and Rob, Sachs points out this format of withholding the who or the what as a way of doing private thought. And this is really what Rob and Abby in the previous clip are doing. They're exploiting the ambiguity of what's being formulated through these private displays and formulating it as subjective experience. And this equivocates over the relevance of their interactional roles, the intelligibility of the resource, and any valence that may emerge as associated with it. So we can look at these on a more mundane level and see how precisely and responsively people calibrate displays of joint access and intelligibility of whatever they're currently experiencing. In extract 10 from the CABNC, Tracy and Annette are shopping for jewellery, and we see how in line 4 in your handouts, Tracy corrects her prior overlapping response to the plural form that Annette has used in her initial reference. So it's really come tightly into lead.
Oh, look at the things with the brooches. Yeah.
And in another extract, slightly less mundane, in 11, Alessandro and Jess are on the Turbine Hall balcony. They're picking out performers that they find attractive. And you might be able to hear how they use both prospective and retrosequential assessments to maintain an account of their concurrent access. So when Jess does a search in response to Alessandro's question about the cute guy in the hat, she displays achieving shared access with this lustful foire. So this process shows how they manage the respective priority of their evaluations. In the you'll have to read the transcripts to see it, but after Ale does this assessment that checks Jess's access and her agreement with his embedded cute assessment, he then upgrades both this ostensible valence of the guy's being beautiful and claims temporal priority, kind of account of having seen him first. So this orientation to subjective experience has some implications for how assessments are treated in the CA literature and how Pomerantz's claims have been developed in later CA work, especially on epistemics and interaction. So heritage suggests that displays of asymmetry of access and by extension displays of asymmetries of knowledge, for example, drive question-answer sequences forwards. And I think these findings suggest that co-present occasioned assessments and other non-canonical actions such as noticings may be normatively produced as retrosequences. So since they start in second position, any response is an optional third position expansion. And the ambiguity of whatever gets involved in this prior tacit location is exploitable by participants as a resource to manage the focused or incipient state of their talk, the relevant description of the resources being optionally occasioned as assessables, and the evaluative relevance of the action itself. And there are structurally similar practices documented in the literature as topic comment structures, left dislocation, prospective indexicals, and broader aspects of story structure. And not all of these methods necessarily deal with evaluation as such, but they all provide mechanisms for formulating and managing interactional roles and accessible resources within what may optionally become reflexively accountable as evaluative actions. So the way that participants calibrate their claims of access and indices of concurrent experience suggests that these may be interconnected in a broader evaluative framework. So I just have a few conclusions that bring this back to the question of whether assessment sequences in the technical sense which they're used in CA can be considered evaluative in an ethnomethodological sense. Firstly, I think these prospective sequences of first and second assessments that use conventionally evaluative terms are only one amongst many ways that participants in interaction can work to achieve evaluation. The co-present occasioned assessments that we've looked at can be produced as retrosequences where the initiating term is produced in second position to a prior tacit first. And this means that the interactional roles, the accessible resources, and the action itself remains only optionally and ambiguously determined. So participants can use this ambiguity to manage the state of talk, their roles as speaker and recipient, and the response relevance of the assessment. And they can use it to manage the relevance of the accessible resource and who can assess it. And so this suggests that valence and relative value, as it's produced through interaction, is only ever retrospectively available and reflexively accountable as interaction, as being evaluative. So the answer to the first question is no, I think. Anyway, I welcome any questions or comments that you have, or you can comment on my ostentatious laptop stand. Any of those things. We're all very welcome. Thank you.
Is it a gorilla pod?
Yes.
Thank you.
I think this is really interesting. I just wanted to question you a little bit about your use of the term retro sequence and retro sequences. So I think you've suggested a number of times in this talk that the status of something as a retro sequence has some bearing on whether or not it's in turn makes a response relevant. And I think that's not the way Shugloff used the term. So the case that he examined in this book was other initiated repair. He mentioned some other ones, but that's the one we really focused on, where something like who initiates a normal adjacency pair sequence, making a second pair part relevant, but it itself is a second item in a different kind of sequence, a retro sequence. So it's both a first and a second in this kind of retrospective sequence. So that one does, you know, make a response normatively relevant. So I think that's an orthogonal dimension to retrosequencing, whether or not something, whether or not the first thing that happens is itself a first pair part or not.
Yeah, I mean, I did a bunch of kind of exegesis of Shegloff's book, and I was mostly referring to page 87, footnote 5, which talks about, I don't know if it's that actually, which talks about noticings as a kind of paradigmatic retrosequence where the thing being invoked does occupy this tacit prior.
I totally agree that these are retrosequences, but I think the issue of whether or not then a response is relevant is kind of an orthogonal issue that doesn't have to do with it being retrosequence.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Questions? Okay, now I'm not sure if...
Footnote 17 on page 87, so you're wrong there.
Stuart Reeves still here? Good. Have you taken large quantities of caffeine?
No.
Thank you, Saul.